Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
We often hear that money can't buy happiness, and most of us believe that. But what if just sometimes it can?
Consider this line from an intriguing book on the subject. It says, "If you think money can't buy happiness, then you're not spending it right." The book is called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, in which Elizabeth Dunn and Michael Norton explore the relationship between money and happiness.
Norton teaches marketing at Harvard Business School, and Dunn is an associate professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. They say it's not about how much money you have, it's about how you use it. And that goes for $5 or $500,000.
It's an intriguing message. So we're going to listen back now to a conversation we had with Michael Norton and Elizabeth Dunn in 2013 when their book Happy Money first came out.
There are so many, there's bookshelves filled in every bookstore of investing and saving and the way to use money and get ready for retirement. And they exist because all of us have some sense that we're not that good at that and we need some help. So sometimes we just ask a family member, what should I do with my money to save and things like that. But when we looked around, we realized that no one told us anything about how to spend our money once we have it. There's no advice to do that. And the reason for that is because we think we know. We walk around and we think, I know how to use my money to get happy. Right. And we buy all kinds of things. And then it turns out research shows those are all the wrong things to make us happy. Our houses, our cars, our TVs, all the things we usually use our money on, they don't do much for us.
And Liz, there's a real interesting question that we can dispense with right away. And this very simple idea that, you know, if I have salary X and next week I get salary 2x X, I'm not going to be twice as happy, right? I mean, there's actually science about this.
Right. So you might be twice as happy for a few minutes, right, when you first get the news that your salary has doubled. The question, though, to us is, well, what about a year later? Once you've adapted to that salary, will it still be making you twice as happy? And the research we've done is quite clear in saying no. Your salary may double, but your happiness isn't likely to.
Does it go up at all, Mike? I mean, just the idea of just having more. I mean, certainly it doesn't make us less happy, does it?
It usually doesn't make people less happy. It's very hard for us to think, though, that more money wouldn't be better. So if you think about, I have my life now and I have this much money, how could having more money not be amazing? And therefore, I'm just going to keep working and trying to get more money. And you're right, it usually isn't the case. You know, more money is usually not bad. It doesn't make you miserable. But if you think about, you know, if you make $20,000 a year and you made an extra $10,000, well, that would make actually a huge difference in your life, and the data shows that. If you make $1 million a year and you make that extra $10,000, same amount of money as when you made $20,000, making $1 million a year, you're already fine, and $10,000 isn't going to do that much. But we don't stop. We keep trying to make more and more and more because we keep thinking that it's the next $10,000 that's going to make everything great. Well, that's not how the world works. It turns out money doesn't solve all of our problems.
Now, Liz and Mike, in your book, you lay out five principles that people can use in their own lives to maximize happiness for themselves and their families around this issue of money. And these principles can be applied to small daily purchases, whether it's buying a cup of coffee, as well as big expenditures like buying a house. So let's go through these ideas first. And the first one, buy experiences rather than things. So Mike, walk us through this one.
This is one that's actually an easy one for people to adopt relatively compared to some of the ones we'll talk about later. So experiences are things not just, you know, a month-long vacation in Europe, but also buying a nice meal out or even taking a coworker to lunch. You know, these are things that their experiences compared to stuff. Because it turns out stuff doesn't make us happy. So we like getting an iPod and we like getting a TV, but they don't do much for us, in part because they're not really that evocative emotionally. Experiences have this quality where when your vacation is coming up in 2 weeks, all you can do is think about it coming up. So you get 2 weeks of anticipation of an experience. Then on the experience itself, that's an amazing thing. It can be much more interesting than staring at a TV. And then when you're done with an experience, you look back at it for the rest of your life. So you go on vacation and you put pictures on your cubicle in the office and you reminisce. We don't really reminisce about the things we bought with pictures in our office, or we look a little bit weird, to be honest. And then the last reason that experiences are so great is because if you think about talking to other people about them, if I sat here right now and said, I bought a TV and let me tell you all about it for the next 30 minutes, you would both hate me. It would be the worst interview ever. Who cares about your TV? But if I said, hey, I went on this really interesting trip to France, and let me tell you about it, it's actually a little bit more interesting. We actually like people more who talk about their own experiences than we do who talk about their stuff.
So one of the principles here, experience over buying things. There's four other principles. We're going to tick through them. But let's get some calls in because we've already got a bunch of people out there that want to get involved in this conversation. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from South Boston. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. My question is, at what point do people start to say, okay, I've got enough material good. That's not really fulfilling. But what sort of number does it sort of transpose over to experiences?
Sure. Liz, you want to take that on?
Sure thing. So, you know, it would make a lot of sense if people said, okay, now I'm making $80,000. I'm going to stop buying so much stuff and start buying some experiences. Interestingly, though, that doesn't necessarily seem to be what happens. I think people's quest for more and more material things seems to continue on up the income spectrum. And indeed, you know, if anything, what we're seeing is that the relationship between income and happiness tends to taper off at about $75,000. So that is to say, people who are making more money above $75,000 don't show any more happiness on a kind of day-to-day basis. And one reason for that may be that they're not actually taking that money and channeling it toward buying more experiences.
So let's move on to another one of these principles because they get better and better, I think. Here's another one. Buy time. And a lot of us complain that we don't have enough of that. We might think we don't have enough money, but actually it's time that's the big precious thing of which we have too little, right? So buy time. So Mike, tell us about this one.
This is one where it's obvious that we should think about having better time for ourselves. You know, mm-hmm. We want to be happy and we want to have time that we enjoy. And yet a lot of the ways that we use our money don't maximize us having really happy time. So if you think about buying a TV, it sounds great, huge TV, it's going to be amazing. And it turns out that what people do when they watch a TV is they sit in a room by themselves and stare at the wall for thousands and thousands of hours. Mm. When you buy a TV and you're thinking it's going to make me happy, what you're not realizing is how it's going to change your time.
Mm. And the way it's going to eat into your time.
Exactly. Yeah. You're going to use that thing. You think it's going to improve your time, and in fact, it's really going to harm how much happiness you get out of your time.
And Liz, in the book, you talk about some companies that have recognized this and reward employees with time rather than money. How does that work?
Well, there's a variety of ways that companies can apply this idea. One that I think is particularly interesting is Patagonia has been giving its employees 2-month sabbaticals to go out and work on environmental causes. Mm. So environmental causes are, of course, linked with what Patagonia does, making outdoor clothing. But getting out there and really being involved with an environmental cause, of course, changes fundamentally what people are doing with their time on a day-to-day basis and can kind of reconnect them, I think, with the underlying mission of the company.
Okay. Another principle you write about involves restricting your spending, but it's not just about saving money. You call it making it a treat. Make it a treat. So, Liz, talk about this principle.
Sure. So the idea here is that really the fundamental barrier to human happiness is our tendency to get used to whatever we've got. So you'd think that like having tons of your favorite things all the time would be the route to happiness. And it turns out it's almost the opposite. Hmm. So a way to increase our happiness is actually to think about what do we like the best and have that stuff a little less often or just take a temporary break.
All right, let's get a couple more callers into this conversation. Steve is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Anthony, I'd like to ask your guests about the phenomenon of having too much money. Young people with trust funds, or for example, if you look at the Kennedy family, I think a lot of the younger Kennedy suffered from having too much money. And then there's the classic phenomenon of the rock star becoming very rich, like the Beatles became, and becoming miserable.
Interesting. Mike, great question. So we've made the point that having more money doesn't necessarily make you happier, but does having too much money make you unhappy?
I think it can. So there's been some interesting research interviewing people who win the lottery. And again, you'd think my life right now is pretty good. You know, I feel about a 5 out of 10. And then if I said, also you get $100 million, you'd think, how could I not be 10 out of 10 after that? That seems like it would definitely be great to have $100 million. But think about what can actually happen when you win $100 million. First off, you might spend $200 million and then you're insanely in debt, and many lottery winners do that. And the other thing that happens when you have a lot of money is everyone starts looking at you like you're a walking dollar sign. So lottery winners talk about how their friends and family completely change their feelings toward them and their relationships because they're constantly asking them for money. And these are things that are very, very real. So, you know, when you have a lot of money, it does not necessarily solve every single problem in your life. You still have to find a partner to go through life with. You still have to I'm from a large family. You still have to deal with your siblings. These are things that money can't always solve. And I think that this caller is really highlighting that fact, that it doesn't fix everything.
I want to move on to the fourth of five principles here. And this is one that really stands in opposition to sort of what's out there in our culture. We all have plastic in our pockets. We can pretty much, you know, if your credit is okay, buy whatever you want, enjoy it right now, pay for it later. You talk about the importance of paying now and consuming later. Liz, why don't you pick that one up?
Sure. We would argue that although, you know, credit cards and new technology are pushing us to consume right away and pay for it later, we should do exactly the opposite. So pay, for example, if you're going to take a vacation at the end of the summer, pay for it now, you know, and then by delaying that vacation until the end of the summer, you get to enjoy the anticipation of looking forward to it. And by the time it actually happens, it's all paid for. That can actually make it feel free, even though, of course, we paid for it. When the payment is in the distant past, people feel as though the experience is free, and everyone loves free.
Let's try to get at least one more call in here. Emily is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. My question is, how are you measuring happiness? We've talked about spending time with family, friends. The Patagonia example is perfect of sort of integrating your career with being an activist and working in the community, a lot of things that I think people miss in their jobs. So what is your criteria of happiness, and what are some sources and resources that you use to figure that out?
Liz, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So it would be fabulous if we had some kind of like happy-o-meter machine we could just stick people in and we'd get their happiness reading. It would be super.
I have one.
Unfortunately, Mike's holding out on me. He won't share it. So we're left with basically asking people. And you can ask people the happiness question in a variety of ways. For example, you can say, you know, how satisfied are you with your life overall on a scale from 1 to 7? You can also ask them, you know, how much did you smile and laugh yesterday? Overall, what we see is that people are pretty good at answering these questions. Their answers to those questions match up pretty closely with what, for example, their friends and family say about them. But the most interesting aspect of these measures, what really matters when it comes to money, is whether we're asked to kind of reflect on our life as a whole and say, you know, am I satisfied with the conditions of my life as a whole? Or am I asked, you know, did I smile and laugh yesterday? So money has a more consistent and stronger relationship with people's overall evaluations of their life. When they're asked to sit back and reflect on their life as a whole, money seems to matter a fair bit. Interestingly, though, income has a really limited impact on people's reports of how they're actually feeling in the moment, or, for example, whether they smiled and laughed yesterday.
Mm. Mike, I just want to ask you this in sort of closing, and that is, all of these suggestions, they make a lot of sense, but they run so counter to all of the messages we get out there about you know, what we hear in advertising, even what the government sort of encourages us to do. How do we resist that message that's out there?
Incredibly difficult. You know, we think about it a lot like, I can tell you all day, every day, that you should eat healthy and you should exercise. And at this point, we all know that, and yet we still just sit around and don't exercise, and we're going to have pizza later. With our research now, we're in the first step of the fight, which is people don't know yet some of the things they can do to change their spending. And then you're absolutely right. The next step after that is, once we have the knowledge, how do we enact it? How do we resist the chocolate that we want to eat all the time? How do we resist trying to get a big house to show off to our friends? Mm-hmm. I think we always think about, if you had an entire budget of all your money and you categorize it in different categories, are you spending it in happy categories or not?
That was Michael Norton and Elizabeth Dunn speaking with us in 2013 about their book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. You can find more about the book at radioboston.org. And stay with us. Coming up, life is good for the two Needham-born brothers behind the $100 million local company. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.